Hello and welcome to Torat Imecha Nachyomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Chavi Swidler Eisenberg, and today we will be studying Sefer Amos, Chapter 5. In the previous parak, we heard Amos's sarcastic tone as he insulted the high society ladies of Shomron, referring to them as the fat cows of the Bashan. These women sustained their lives of luxury by taking advantage of the poor and disenfranchised among them. In order to feed their voracious appetites, they encouraged their husbands to pursue corruption to sustain their immoral lifestyles. When punishment came, it began with agricultural consequences of drought, followed by scarcity, disease, plagues, and finally, destruction by an enemy. Despite the clear indication that these were all divine consequences due to the people's actions and the corrupt nature of their society, the elites of Israel refused to see their culpability and ignored the words of the prophet. Amos described their inevitable destruction as similar to Sodom and Amorah, which were overturned. Also, those who had enslaved the ancient Israelites in Egypt had their entire economic system wiped out through plagues. How tragic that the people of Israel, who emerged from Egyptian slavery, had transformed themselves into the same kind of oppressors as those who had oppressed them. Chapter 5 continues this style of rebuke and includes a kinah, a poem of lament over the inevitable destruction. This chapter has 27 psukim, the longest one in the Sefer. The first half of the parak, verses 1 through 17, is the end of the second section of Sefer Amos, which features messages that begin with shim'u, listen. The second half of the chapter, verses 18 through 27, begins the third part of Sefer Amos and discusses a Yom Hashem, a day of God, a day of reckoning that is coming. Verses 1 through 17 lament about the fall of Israel. We will divide this first half of the chapter even further into seven short paragraphs. Verses 1 through 3 are the opening lines of the dirge. 4 through 6 encourage Israel to seek out God and not look for him in the cities of idol worship. Verse 7 features a short rebuke. Verses 8 through 9 is a hymn featuring cosmic praise of God. Verses 10 through 13 is, once again, a rebuke. 14 through 15 returns to the theme of seeking God. 16 and 17 returns to the dirge theme. For those experienced with textual study of Tanakh, you may recognize that the entire section, as I described it, is a chiasm. The term chiasm comes from the Greek letter chi and looks the same as the letter X, an inverting structure. Chiastic structures are commonly found in Tanakh, where the beginning elements of a section echo the ending elements of the same section, moving inward in a pattern of A, B, C, D, C, B, A. This draws our attention to the central theme, which in this case is the fourth section. Therefore, it's good to keep this in mind as we get to verses 8 and 9, which is a hymn about God's creative powers, as this is clearly the focal point. Now that we have this structure in mind, let's return to the beginning of the chapter to look at some of the verses in depth. Verses 1 to 3 are the first paragraph of the kinah, the lament. Verse 1, time for me to lament you. Time for me to eulogize you before you're even dead. The language employed here is incredibly shocking. Instead of lamenting with you or on your behalf, the prophet is lamenting over you, as if the audience is an already dead body, a loved one who has been tragically killed in the prime of her life. Amos is not inviting the audience to join him in the rites of mourning. Rather, he's describing them as the very subject of the lament. This jarring language is designed to wake up the people from their stupor. Verse 2 is an important pasuk in rabbinic discussion. Nafla lo tosif kum betulat Yisrael, natsha al admata ein mikima. Fallen is the maiden of Israel. She will not rise again, abandoned with no one to lift her up. There's a major dispute among the commentators on how to read this devastating verse. Is it about the finality of destruction, or is it a message of hope that the fallen virgin daughter of Israel will stop falling further? While most Mefarshim understand this verse as pretty depressing, declaring permanent exile for Israel's northern kingdom, the Metzudot, Rav David Altshuler of Prague, explains that this is not describing the northern people of Israel as never returning from exile, but is specifically about the monarchy of the northern kingdom. This separate dynasty will not rise again. There will no longer be a split in the kingdom. This means that while the fall of the kingdom of Israel is unavoidable, the exiled people can be brought back in the future to be one united nation once again under the Davidic dynasty of Judah. Verse 3 describes the extent of the destruction, where only 10% of the exiled population will survive. It's unclear if they are being decimated by a plague or a foreign conqueror. Either way, this is a terrifying message. In verses 4 through 6, God encourages us to search for the divine and live. In verse 5, he tells them to stop going to Beit El and Gilgal, to the fake prophets and fake worship, and don't go to Be'er Sheva. They are nothingness. Amos plays with his words, using the word Even, which means stone, and it's spelled with a vet, but it also plays off the word Aven, spelled with a vav, which means hevel, nothingness. This idea plays off the original reference to Beit El from Yaakov in Bereshit chapter 28. There, Beit El is the place where Yaakov concretized his covenant with God. Now, the same location is referenced in sharp contrast as a place where Am Yisrael violated the same covenant. Verses 8 and 9, which are the center of our chiastic structure, contain a short hymn that interrupts the rebuke that frames it. The hymn addresses God as the master of creation, first naming specific star clusters such as Pleiades, Orion, and Ursa Major. The mention of individual astrological formations is very unusual in Tanakh, as the overall message of the prophets tends to be counterculture to the surrounding pagan beliefs of the time, which credited these constellations with control over man's destiny. The hymn then shifts focus to God's creative and potentially destructive powers here on earth, including his control of water and its power to destroy. The prophet reminds the people that God's mastery over creation is not simply an automatic process that he set up to run. God creates, God destroys, and he can use those same forces to both run predictable patterns and turn those same rhythms upside down, wiping away fortresses that we thought were invincible. In verse 10, Amos returns to the topic of rebuke. They hate the one who rebukes at the gate. The gate is a reference to the municipal court system, which you may recall from Megillat Rut. When Boaz wants to go to court to officially redeem Elimelech's field, and along with that field, marry Ruth, the site where the judges meet is at the city gates, which, in addition to being a place for official proceedings, is also the location of public markets and other gatherings. So the one who rebukes at the gates is publicly admonishing the judges for their corruption. And they don't like to hear this, so they shoot the messenger, meaning Amos, chasing him away rather than taking his rebuke to heart. Verse 11 features the unusual word boshaschem. This word is an example of a biblical phenomenon referred to as a hapax legomenon, which is a Latin term that biblical scholars use to describe words or phrases that only appear once or very few times in Tanakh, making them difficult to translate with certainty. Therefore, there can be a number of different interpretations to this word, boshaschem, and the classic commentaries each define the word slightly differently based upon the context of the rest of the verses. Rashi and Malbim translate it to mean to trample, while the etymological dictionary of Hebrew suggests, based on ancient Akkadian, that it means to draw farm rent. This approach is supported by the 12th century French commentator Rav Eliezer of Bogensi, who interprets the phrase as taking their houses and inheritances in court. Further support may be found in the continuation of the verse, which has a parallel phrase which accuses the people of taking grain allotments from the poor. In addition, we will see that verse 12 continues to refer to injustices that the poor experience at the city gates. So whichever way we interpret this unusual word, boshaschem, it's clear from the context of the verses that this entire section of prophecy is referring in some way to the wealthy taking advantage of the poor by using a corrupt legal system to deprive them of their basic needs. The continuation of verse 11 describes the corruption of the wealthy who take advantage of the poor in order to build fancy houses out of luxurious building materials, but they will not end up living in these mansions. You planted beautiful vineyards, but you will not drink the wine. These two ideas mentioned in the Pasuk, of building a house and not getting to live in it, and planting a vineyard and not getting to benefit from it, sound very familiar. This is similar to an idea mentioned in Devarim chapter 20 in Parshat Shoftim. Before Bnei Yisrael go out to war, the officers of the nation, called Shotrim, are commanded to stand in front of the army and ask, "Who has built a house and not yet dedicated it? Let him go back home, lest he die in battle, and someone else will live in his house. Who has planted a vineyard and not yet harvested it? Let him return home, lest he die in battle, and someone else harvest it. And who has betrothed a woman and not yet married her? Let him return home, lest he die in battle, and someone else marry her." This very same concept of building a house, planting a vineyard, and betrothing a woman, all without benefiting, is mentioned again later on in Sefer Devarim, in the section of biblical rebuke called the Tochacha. The Tochacha is a harsh series of rebukes and warnings about what will happen to the Jewish people if they don't keep the covenant, and build lives based on chesed and mishpat, loving kindness and justice, and instead live lives contrary to the values that God wants. Then, these punishments will fall upon them. The punishments listed in the Tochacha section include these disappointing experiences of making these three types of investments: building a home, developing a livelihood, and establishing a family, all without ever seeing the fruits of one's labors. While there's no mention of marrying a woman in this verse in Amos, nevertheless, the first two descriptions of building a house and planting a vineyard sound eerily familiar to these sections in Devarim. Rabbi David Foreman has a series of shiurim on his website, alephbeta.org, about these verses in Devarim chapter 20, which focuses on these officers, the Shotrim, who were charged with overseeing who from the nation would be sent home before going out to war. Rabbi Foreman explains that these rules for war were established as a form of restorative justice for wrongs committed in Egypt by other Jewish officers, also referred to as Shotrim, who were unwittingly coerced into becoming part of Paro's slave enterprise to oppress the Jews in Egypt. The rules for war, mentioned in Devarim 20, were established as a tikkun, a form of repair for the Jewish Shotrim in Egypt. Consider, who, aside from a soldier who dies in battle, who else builds a house and doesn't get to live in it? Who else plants a vineyard without benefiting from their own work? Slaves! Now, when Bnei Israel go out to war, instead of Shotrim being part of enforcing a system of slavery, their new prescribed role for the nation is to ensure that no one in our society is oppressed to the point where they cannot enjoy the benefits of their own labor. I'd like to suggest that this idea, echoed here in Amos, is Amos's brutal critique of the society established in Shomron, where the poor and disenfranchised have become so oppressed that they once again are essentially slaves, but this time at the hands of their own Jewish brothers. Perhaps this is why the punishment delineated here in Amos is most fitting for these upper-class Israelites who recreated a society that, in a way, turned the lower-class Jews into slaves, who toil without enjoying the benefits of their own hard work. This punishment is a fulfillment of the promises of the Tochacha, which delineates what would happen if the nation stopped keeping the laws and became corrupt. Since the people of Shomron have repudiated the values of the mitzvot and their foundational principles of chesed and mishpat, loving kindness and justice, and instead set up a society based upon the oppression of the poor, therefore, these rich people will endure the same experience as a slave, working hard to build something important without ever being able to enjoy the fruits of their own labors. In verses 14 through 15, Amos turns to the people and pleads with them to shift course, to seek out God. It's not too late to change their ways and avoid all of these terrible punishments. Start now. Do good. Support justice. Maybe God will let a small remnant of you survive. It's too late to avoid all the punishments, so we can't expect more salvation than that. Verses 16 through 17 return to the outer frame of the chiasm, to the dirge theme, describing the wails and laments that will be found in all the streets, a cry of "Ho, ho!" which means, "Alas, alas," or "Oy vey." The farmers will seek out professional dirge writers to help them write lamenting poems. Many Mefarshim explain that in both biblical and rabbinic times, professional dirge writers and wailers were employed to participate in funerals and other sad ceremonies. Did you notice that these two verses have a milah mancha, a light word motif which is repeated three times in just these two verses. Did you catch it? The word is mispaid, wailing. The repetition of this word highlights the intense mourning and the deliberate intensification of weeping, which Amos anticipates and about which he warns his audience. Section 2 of the chapter begins with verse 18. This is also the beginning of a different segment of the Sefer, the third of four parts to the entire book, which continues through the end of chapter 6. This section features prophecies that begin with the word hoy and include a discussion about the day of God, which should be terrifying. This is a day of darkness, no light. Amos corrects the mistaken idea that some Israelites have. They were looking forward with anticipation to the day of God, as originally described in Shirat HaZinu, Moshe's song in Devarim chapter 32. Put simply, the prophet immediately quashes the naive fascination with Yom HaShem, which the citizens of Shomron believe will serve to finally defeat their enemies, as well as to demonstrate, regionally, if not universally, their status as God's chosen nation. Here, Amos warns them that this day of divine revelation is not something to long for, but something to dread. Verse 19. Just as a man runs away from the lion and experiences relief, and then a moment after he escapes, he meets a bear, and then he comes home, also with intense relief, and then he lays his hand on the wall, and a snake bites him. In Tanakh, both the lion and the bear, Omai, are considered to be absolutely terrifying animals, and if someone is fortunate enough to escape one, let alone both, they are considered to be extremely blessed. How tragic, then, to find one's end after all this from a snake bite. In verses 21 through 23, Amos declares, "I hate your sacrifices. I don't desire the offerings of fat cows," which returns us to the imagery of chapter 4, the fat cows of the Bashan. "I don't want to hear your hymns or spiritual songs." The word here used is navel, a stringed instrument. It is also a play on words because the word naval, which is spelled the same way, means a disgusting person. Not only does God not want your songs, but God doesn't want your disgustingness. Verse 24 reads, "Let justice roll down like water." Some of you may recognize the English version of this verse from the famous "I Have a Dream" speech of Martin Luther King Jr. in 1963, where, inspired by our prophet Amos, he envisioned a day where injustice would no longer reign and righteousness will prevail. Verse 25, "Do I really want your karbanot, your sacrificial offerings? Did I ever want them in the desert?" Now, obviously, God commands us in sacrificial worship, so the answer to this question is yes, but not like this. I want sincere offerings. That's what God is saying. "Therefore, I will exile you beyond Damascus," which brings us back to chapter 1, where we heard about the unforgivable sins of Damascus and the other surrounding nations. Today, we learned the two parts of chapter 5. Part 1 featured a chiastic structure of elements, A, B, C, D, C, B, A, a dirge, encouragement to seek out God, rebuke, cosmic hymn, rebuke, seek out God, once again, a dirge. The message of this section is to encourage the people of Shomron that even though the destruction is imminent, it's still possible to change their ways, to choose to rebuild society based upon tzedakah and mishpat, without corrupt court systems, and to limit the scope of their punishment. Section 2 is the beginning of a new section of the Sefer, discussing the Day of God, which sounds awe-inspiring at first glance, but really should make you shake in your boots, as this reckoning that will come on this day is not only exciting, but terrifying. Thank you for studying together, Le'iloi Nishmat Gilbert Karsanti, Menachem Mendel Ben Sa'ud.